I've been thinking ever since I was back there. I was wondering if I could. No. And I do this when I talk, so maybe I won't talk so long. There's a blessing in that, huh? Well, are y'all nervous? Maybe you should be. My name's Danny. I'm an alcoholic. And it's my AA birthday, 25 years, as you witnessed. Yeah. There's a lot of sobriety in here. So 55 years. Holy cow. I was pretty young then. Oh, that's bright. I went to the restroom before I came up here, but that was an hour ago. And so I have a deal with somebody. They're going to come up and take over. If I leave, don't think anything about it. It's we can't have any accidents up here. Not with new people, you know. Anyway, my name's Danny. I'm an alcoholic. And Jamie and I have had a wonderful time. This is an interesting place. It's not really like Texas, actually, at all. It's quite different. And the food's different, too. It's hot. Food's hot. And Jamie wants to try everything. She's the redhead back there. And she wants to try everything. I'm not so adventuresome. You know, I find one thing I like it, I eat it over and over again. I've had watermelon. A lot of it. And when we first got here, Eric picked us up and we were in Bangkok. We spent the night in Bangkok after like an 85-hour ride over here. What a trip. But fortunately, you sprung for economy. So, which is great because I'm only 6'3". And it really worked out good. I got to know everybody, you know. They wouldn't let me go upstairs, you know. But anyway, we're very grateful to be here. I wasn't going to be places like this, I can tell you. 25 years ago, I was on my way back to prison. And that's true. Alcoholics Anonymous just intervened in my life, and I'm grateful. The greatest thing that ever happened to me. And the people that are new here, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. We're really, really glad you're here. I know you're thrilled to be here, aren't you? Yeah. Oh, great. I finally did this. Yeah. How good for you. Yeah, I know. That's what I was thinking, too. And Toy, was it reading how it works in Thai? That was amazing. That's exactly the way it sounded to me 26 years ago. I didn't know they could do that again. Holy cow. And it's a lot longer in Thai, isn't it? Huh? That's what Tony and I, my buddy Tony back here from England, we were talking. I said, that's a lot of words. I've already introduced myself a couple of times, so I must be nervous too. Let's see. I like to tell you, you remember Dr. Bob Smith's son, it's Smitty. You know, he passed away, 2 years ago, I think. What a wonderful Al-Anon, greatest sense of humor in the world. And he loved to tell this story because he thought it was apropos when you consider us. He liked to talk about the two rather wealthy moose hunters, or they're just hunters. They like to fly from Texas and go up north, and they would get this bush pilot to fly them in onto a nice lake, and they would get out with their guns and their whiskey, and they would spend a week hunting. And, you know, this year they dropped them off, man, and they go out and they have this great time and they kill two moose. And when the bush pilot, who's a new guy, he comes in a pontoon plane and he lands and he comes in to pick them up and he sees these guys over here. They're just wiped out. You know, they've got shell casings up to their ankles, beer bottles, whiskey bottles, and these two big moose. And he looks at them and he says, listen, we can't leave with all of that. That's too much weight. And they said, well, why not? We did it last year. Well, this guy's new with the company, and he's thinking these are good customers. They're drunk. They're idiots, but they're good paying customers. And he said, well, maybe I'm wrong. He said, okay, load it up. They got in there. They took off. They got about 300 yards, and they crashed. And the drunks come up out of the wreckage and look around. They say, where are we? And the guy said, I think we're about 100 yards from where we crashed last year. Oh, look at this. Well, I like this guy.
I was starting to do this anyway.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Oh, good. My arm was going to sleep anyway. So anyway, that's the only funny story I can ever really remember other than my life, which is, you know, it's kind of like yours. I usually start my talk off telling you about the first meeting that I consciously remember attending in Alcoholics Anonymous. My wife had pushed me out of the car in front of the 710 Club in Midland, Texas. I didn't really want to go, but I was too weak to resist. And the reason she did it is because she had a date with her boyfriend. And I thought that was going to ruin our marriage, you know. And I had hepatitis. I'd been drunk for several days, and she pushed me out of there. And you know, so of course I've got to do something. I've got to save my marriage. So I go inside this club, which I don't know what it is, to get a ride, you know, to go do what I need to do. And hell, I went in there and they were just thrilled to see me. They said, man, this guy just walking in, a wet drunk, just what we needed. We're all depressed. Here's somebody to work on. So you know how they are, man. They just gather around. You want orange juice? You would like honey? How about some chocolate? If you don't drink, you won't get drunk, he said. I said, yeah, I know that. Yeah, I've got that part down. And I said, I need a ride out here. They said, well, we're going to have a meeting. And I thought, well, I guess I'll have to wait for the meeting and then get a ride out of here. So I get in there and I go to this meeting. And this meeting, people get up behind the podium and they say that they're an alcoholic and they tell some horrible story and everybody claps. I thought, man, this is a long meeting, too. And, when it was over, they all got up and held hands and said a prayer. And, man, they broke. I thought, well, I can get out of here. And here come a guy with a flat top. You know, he just a redneck is what he was. He was a lot worse than me. And he came right straight for me. He had a bunch of young guys with him. And he came right up to me and he said, we're going to Baskin Robbins for ice cream. Would you like to go? I thought, be still my beating heart. And then, of course, in my head, what I thought was, there is no way on God's green earth that I'm going off with a bunch of geriatrics for ice cream on Monday night while my wife is out with her boyfriend. That ain't happening. What came out of my mouth was, you know, sure, I'd love to go. So I'm sitting there holding a Rocky Road ice cream. It's melting. And these guys are talking to me about Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, this guy, again, he says, you know, Danny, if you don't take a drink, you won't get drunk. I said, good. And the kid with him, he said, listen, let me explain it to him. He said, it's not the caboose that kills you. It's the locomotive. I thought, I should have brought pencil and paper. This is deep stuff, but right now I need to go find my wife. So you wonder, if you're worried about what you're saying to the new guy, don't worry. He's got his whole little script going all of his own, you know. He just standing there looking at you thinking, oh, man, sober. And, it, you know, being sober is an interesting event for an alcoholic, isn't it? It's the greatest thing in the world that's ever happened to me. Alcoholics Anonymous is the most amazing movement in the world. It's the largest growing fellowship in the world that no one wants to join. You know? I got my little key with the bell on it. Put that over. That thing's heavy. Have I started drinking yet? No. Well, I'm gonna cut out about 2 hours of my talk since we have a big countdown around here, and that's the biggest countdown I've ever seen. I mean, thank God you didn't have 1,000 people show up here. Or that banquet would be, it would be pretty cold by now. No, this is the most important thing. It's the most important thing in the world that you know that you're loved here, you're recognized here, you're needed here, you're wanted here. If no one else, if you ever felt like no one else wanted you, here you're wanted, here you're needed, here you count. You have work to do here. The fun and games out there may be over, but in here, your life takes on meaning. In here, things be, you realize that everything you've been through, everything you felt, all the separation that you've had from humanity will melt away, and you'll be able to use that to reach other people. And it'll be the greatest thing that ever happened to you, ever. And you won't want to do it when it's your turn to do it. Yeah. I want to be a sponsor, but I don't want to have to sit and listen to you. You know? I mean, you know what I mean? I mean, that's kind of the way we are, but my sponsor says you have to sit and listen. You have to share. You have to read the book. We have, you know, so you do what your sponsor says. You don't know what it is that he knows, but you're afraid it's something that you've got to have. And so you do what he says because you want what he has. I wanted what my sponsor had. He had a blonde wife. He had a really nice car and a good job, and everybody looked up to him. They liked him. And I wanted to be just like that. I thought John Henry McDonald was the best thing in life. He was the first guy I ever heard and identified with. He was the guy that when he sat down and he talked and they listened, he said, come on in this house. Get a cup of coffee and sit down. You know, I told him, I said, I'm an alcoholic. He said, yeah, you are. Yeah, you are. And I said, man, I'm at home. And I've known him now for 27 years. In fact, I don't have any friends from my past. I don't know if I had any friends back then either. But you know, today, I mean, I go all over, and I don't even know why. I mean, anybody in this room really could clear their throat. If I catch a heart attack and fall over, one of you could just get up and say, our next speaker, you know, it's... Because that's just the way it is. I mean, we're all here because we're not all here, you know. And we can all talk about that. I want you to pay attention when I share, because there's some things that you need to know. You get a big book. If it's Thai, we'll get you one of those that are hard to read. But if you read English, get just a regular one. And just read the black stuff, you know. We just do that. And the reason I want to tell you, you don't want to go just strictly on oral stuff. You need to have a big book because, like, for one thing, your speaker tonight is an escaped mental patient. I was never released. I mean, you know, I got away, and they just said, well, we'll catch him one of these days. So, and, if you're new here and you're wanting to find a direction and hope and happiness in life, if you'll look around this room, what you'll see is we have people here who have divorces. We've been in mental institutions. We've been in the gutter. We've absolutely destroyed our lives and the lives of people around us. And we'd like to guide you into your new life. This is the place where the inmates do run the asylum. You want to know who's in charge? Ask any one of us. Because of humility, we won't say that we are. But we won't say we aren't either. But it's a great place. You know, I remember trying to find the one in charge. Bill's dead. There's got to be an opening. And, no. I came from a I came from a mother that was very young, which I'm glad for that. My mom was 14 years old when she married my dad. He was 19. She had me when she was 15. They've now been together for 62 years. Is that cool or what? I haven't even had that many wives. I mean, and I'm a marrying man. But they were just terribly poor. I could talk for a long time. I was the only child until I was almost 7 years old. I felt different. I mean, I didn't, and I don't know how you tell people when you're 7 years old that you feel different. You don't know that you feel different. You just look around. I would just look around and it seemed like everybody seemed to be fitting in and okay, and they knew what to do, and I didn't. I felt better when I was alone. I had my fantasy world, my invisible friends, you know, which I still have. You've told me to quit listening to them. And I had all those things going with me, and what I really needed was a drink. But you know, I mean, I'm 7 for crying out loud. No one really was interested in seeing if it would help. I did okay until I was like 13. When I was 13, 14 years old, I took my first drink. I took my first drink because I wanted to impress some of the older guys that I wanted to fit in with. I wanted to be like them. I wanted them to like me. I didn't know what it was that it took to fit in anywhere, but I wanted to be with these guys. So I took a drink, and man, it just went down, and my fingers tingled, my toes warmed up, my stomach got all warm. I felt, you know, I just felt free from that thing that kept me apart from everybody else. I just felt I'm in charge. I'm okay. I can fit in. I got in a lot of trouble. I wrecked my mother's car. I wasn't supposed to have it to begin with at that age, but I wrecked it. I got in a lot of trouble. Everything that could happen wrong, it did happen. And all I can remember is woke up the next day, I felt terrible. I was in a lot of trouble, and I thought, I am doing this again. And that's a common theme in Alcoholics Anonymous. It does something. Alcohol did something so significant for me that there was no way in the world that I was not going to do it again. Now, like you, I paid a terrible price to have that experience over and over and over and over again. I mean, the consequences to me and to my family, and in fact to society that I came in touch with, was just massive, just like with you. But I couldn't live with it. I had like an internal storm inside of me. You know, it's just these swirling feelings and thoughts, and I couldn't bear to live with it. You know, I would try to repress it, and I would get depressed, or I'd have explosive feelings. But if I took a drink, that externalized. I calmed down inside, and I felt like the eye of the storm. But, man, you know, everybody around me said, oh, he needs to quit drinking. That's not good. And I didn't know how to tell him, you don't understand. If I quit drinking, all that stuff comes right back inside me. And then you don't have a problem, but I do. And I'd much rather you have one. So without being able to express that or have any idea that it was having a different effect on me than it did on anyone else, that's where it led me into prisons, mental institutions, several marriages, which I'll tell you about a few. I don't want you to be late for your buffet. I don't know what we're having, but I'll bet it's fish. But at any rate, I joined the Navy. Actually, before I joined the Navy, I need to back up. I didn't tell you about a couple of things that happened to me very early. And they thought this boy is crazy, so they sent me to the insane asylum, a mental institution, Big Springs State Hospital in Big Springs, Texas. I went over there because I ran away from home, and I was depressed, and I couldn't fit in. And I stayed for 3 months. They introduced me to Thorazine. Thorazine is an interesting drug. If it's properly administered, it doesn't really affect your thinking all that much. It just affects your motor skills. so that I'm an anxious person who needs to go somewhere, but my body won't cooperate. So you'd be sitting in a locked ward in a mental institution. They open the door, you think, well, I'm getting out of here. And when they all come back in and close the door, you think, well, the next time they open that door, then I'm going. So eventually I got off of that stuff, and they thought I was better. I think, you know, when you keep a kid on Thorazine for like 3 months and then you take him off, I mean, I guess it's hard to find out whether he's better or not. He'd just been immobile. But I got out and I was out in no time at all. I got a hold of my mother's car again. I wrecked it again. I got drunk again. I went to jail. I went back to the state hospital. They put me on a locked ward where they were giving out shock treatments. I made some friends. These guys were getting shock treatments, and these were my first really good buddies. But the more shock treatments that they got, the less they were able to interact with me. So I felt like we probably need to get him out of here. So on Visitor's Day, I stole a car and loaded these two guys up, and we went 40 miles away to my hometown and got two more guys who should have been in that hospital. And we headed for Mexico, which was 270 miles. I don't know how many kilometers that is, but 270 miles away. So we headed off down there, and it was a very exciting time for me because this is my first gang. I'm the leader, and you know, I'm very energized over this whole thing. So we head out, and we would stop in little mom and pop stores and go in and create a diversion to get supplies. And when you're escaped mental patients, that's not a problem at all. So we would get supplies, get something to drink, and hit the road. But the further we got from that hospital, it became apparent that these guys were in that hospital for a reason. It became increasingly difficult for me to gather my gang up and get them back in the car. You know, hell, they'd just wander off everywhere, and, you know, you stop for supplies, and, you know, it was really difficult. I was getting stressed out, so. But we finally got across the border. When we got across the border, we got into what is known as Boys Town. This is where men become men, or boys become men. Maybe not. But anyway, we were over there drinking, and that's when I realized I've just completely run out of a plan. This is as far as my plan goes. About that time, I heard a noise, and one of the guys with me had just killed a parrot that belonged to a lady that worked down there. And there was a big commotion, and they called the federales. So we thought we're going back to America. So we tried to beat it back to the border, but the federales caught us, and we went to jail in Mexico. And man, that's a bad place, you know. I didn't speak the language. It's almost like being here. I couldn't even ask for water. All I wanted to know was how to call my mother. My mother was going to wind up in Al-Anon, but it was 20 years yet, and I could drive her like a new car. So anyway, my mom did find me, and she came down and she got me out of the jail. But she didn't get those other guys out because she thought I was they were a bad influence on me. And I had to ride back across the international border on the hood of the car because I had lice, and she didn't want me in the car. They got me all cleaned up and getting new clothes, and we headed for my home, which was, like I said, 270 miles away. And she had brought one of her little church friends to support her in this. So what they did is they practiced what was her first version of aversion therapy, which is she turned that, she put it on Mexican music, the kind with, you know, the mariachi music, and turned it as loud as it could go, and played that all the way back to Midland, Texas, read out of the Bible to me, and, you know, basically tried to shame me all the way back, and it really worked. I hate that music still. But I got through that, and my dad said, well, I don't know what to do. Well, you know, maybe we should let him join the Navy. And I joined the Navy. I joined the Navy the day I turned 17. They put me in the Seabees. I grew big and strong. My drinking, I got to where I could just I seemed like I could drink anybody under the table. And I mean, I was having a ball. I loved being in the Navy, except for getting up early for no particular reason. And, you know, and people ordering you around. And, you know, I didn't, other than that, I liked it a lot. I liked having a uniform and belonging to a group. But that's about as good as I got. I wound up over in Guam. And you guys out here, you know all about these places. Guam is not a big place. And it's very hard to leave Guam. That's probably for me. I didn't even know anyone knew I was over here. Anyway, Guam's a very small place. And I got to drinking, and I would, you know, I would leave the base, and they would pick me up, and I knew all the shore patrol. They'd pick me up in a Ganya and bring me back, and I would miss roll call, and you know, it was getting bad, and I started drinking at the Club Macombo, and one night I met some British sailors, and they said that they had liquor rations on their ship, and I thought, that can't be possible, so I went to find out. And when I came to, I was in a lot of trouble. They left, you know, and that's a problem for you when, you know, when you're an American sailor aboard a British ship and it's not, you know, it's gone. It's in our book, it says the alcoholic's problems pile up on him, become astonishingly difficult to solve. Well, that's true. So, but they worked it all out and got me back, you know. And I went as low as you could go in the Navy. And I got back to the Camp Pendleton area. I was in the Seabees. And I started leaving and blacking out and blowing up, just losing my cool, you know. And life just went downhill, and finally they decided to arrange for me to have a general discharge under honorable conditions. So I was out of the Navy. I got out of the Navy, and it was one of the, you know, I was very animated and happy that day, and making fun of all the guys as they boarded a ship to leave for war. But inside, I felt ashamed, and I was sad, and I thought, you know, this is one more time something that really meant something to me I can't have and I can't do. And these relationships with these guys, however dysfunctional, they were my friends. And they were off, and here I was standing alone feeling sorry for myself. I made my way up and down the California coast. I learned about Skid Row and about selling blood. I learned about stealing and hustling people. Speed. I love speed. I like to stay awake for everything, you know. Drink whiskey, take speed. Hide outside your house, see who's watching you. Great life. God, I hated to give that up, you know. Who's going to watch us now? So, anyway, I made it up and down all over California, and I just got in so much trouble with people, and just I wound up heading out back to Texas. I got back in Texas, and in Texas I was in Midland, Odessa area, and I met some guys who were, they were just like the coolest guys in the world. I mean, everybody liked them. They only came out at night and had a nice car, and they carried guns, and they had money, and everybody was afraid of them, and they drank good whiskey, and I wanted to be just like them. And they were stealing mercury out of oil field gauges and selling it on the black market. And they needed some help, and I applied for the job. And pretty soon, you know, I'm one of the guys. You know, I'm carrying a gun, and I've got people that I think respect me, but they're just afraid because, you know, we're nuts. And wasn't long till, I don't know if y'all know about the Texas Rangers, but I do. And wasn't long till they showed up, and I wound up getting a 5-year sentence, and it was probated. It was probated, and I was told that if I would hold down a job and report to my parole officer and stay out of those bars and not drink and don't hang out with those kind of people, that I could live this down, and it would be expunged from my record, and I would be, you know, it would be a tough lesson, but I could move on with my life. And I really, really wanted to do that. I was grateful for the opportunity. I never wanted to drink again. I didn't want to be around those kind of people. I knew they were right. I wanted my family to be proud of me. I didn't like it that somehow my dad's a very hardworking old World War II veteran, and he's got him a business, and I got two brothers that are just good kids trying to go to school, and my mom, who's just at her wit's end trying to figure out how to fix this one boy that it just means everything to her. It means everything to her. She nearly lost her mind trying to help me. And you know, and here I am, I'm showing up in the newspaper, you know, and I mean, they're embarrassed. They don't know what to do. And I'm ashamed of myself. So I do want to do the right thing. I got a job. It lasted 3 weeks. 3 weeks. I just couldn't take anymore. I just wanted to have a couple of drinks, take the edge off. I come to in Dallas. I meet some guys who are doing the same thing. I wound up getting 13 5-year sentences and sent off to the Texas Department of Corrections. That's Huntsville. And I learned about agriculture and violence. I learned about making your own, we call it chop, make your own whiskey. I learned about gangs. And I learned my way around in the world. And when I got out, you know, I knew I would be back. And I was right, I was back. I got out and, you know, I was thinking, what in the world is going on? I've got to do something. My mother didn't have any skills to teach me. She was just in a survival mode from the moment that she was born, practically. And my dad was just a hardworking guy who didn't know how to interact. So my mom the only thing she ever told me that I really recall was that she said, son, what you need is a wife and a job and a kid and a car and a bank account. In a home, you'll be okay. So I looked for a woman that had kids and a bank account and a job and a car. I married her, and my mother was wrong. I was not okay. So anyway, I married this girl. I met her, and I met her that week. I married her later that week. And it was like the worst 2 weeks of my life, that marriage. It was real stressful, and her mother was just a real bad drunk, and it was just terribly uncomfortable. So I left. I went back to my bar. I now had a base of operations. It's Dave's Restaurant in Odessa, Texas. And I'm sitting in my restaurant, knocking back some cold beer, and don't ask me where I get the money to do this. I don't know how a drunk manages to stay drunk, but I managed. So I'm sitting in here one night, and I see this girl. And she's kind of sobbing gently over in the corner. She's really good looking. And I go over to see if she's okay. And we get to talking, and it turns out that her problem is that she's pregnant. And this was back in the 60s, and there was a social stigma attached to being an unwed mother. And she couldn't go home to her family pregnant. And it was a very sad story. And I got to thinking that I don't even have a home to go to, and I started crying. So... between us, we hatched a plan that we should get married. And so 3 days, you had to wait 3 days. And 3 days later, we're married. And I called my mom and said, Mom, I'm married. And she said, well, I know that. I said, well, you couldn't. I just did it. And she said, oh, you have a wife. And I thought, well, that's a problem. I hadn't even considered. There's always details. I don't think about details. I'm a big picture sort of a guy. You know, quick fix. So I thought, well, I'm already married. I might as well do my honeymoon. So about a fifth whiskey, and we got on the Greyhound bus and headed to our new home, which was in a place called McAlester, Oklahoma. And we drove up there, and I entertained the passengers. And by the time we got there, I was pretty well lit. And got off the bus, and my new father-in-law was sitting there to pick us up, and he had this big limousine. It was chauffeur-driven, and he was well-dressed and obviously very influential, and I thought, well, I finally done something right. And we went to his house, and I passed out. His house was like this mansion with, I don't even know how many, 12 or 13 bedrooms. I mean, this guy had it going on. He had servants everywhere. They all wore white. I woke up, and I walked out on the veranda, and I looked right across the street from where he lived, and I saw his place of business. I had married the warden of McAllister State Prison's daughter. And I thought, what are the chances of this? As Eric says, is this, was that odd or was that God? That was just like, I thought, well, I'm very stressed out with this, you know, so I've got to go. So about this time, my life takes a turn for the worse. I needed a design for living, you know. All of that crisis management was all I'd ever had. So anyway, I wound up back in the at my bar in West Texas, and I was sitting in my bar in West Texas just doing what I do, which was hustling pool and hustling drinks and, you know, just trying to keep the edge off. And my mother shows up and she says, come on, we're going to court. And I said, what for? She said, well, you're getting a divorce and an annulment today because you're a bigamist. You're in a lot of trouble. And so she took me to court, and we go in here, and the judge didn't get to say anything. I didn't get to say anything. The lawyer didn't say anything. My mother did all the talking. You know, those Al-Anons, I mean, she explained everything that was going on, what needed to happen. She said, there's no point in prosecuting this child. Anybody who would do stuff like this, they're already tormented enough. Locking them up will not help. And she said, we've got a place down in Brady, Texas. We'll move him down there. We got him, get him a good job. They got me a good job in Brady, Texas. And my good job was in a mohair plant. This is where they take mohair from goats and weave it into a rope. And my job was to stand by a loom, and there was a 55-gallon drum that was there, and that loom would just weave that rope in there, and it'd take about 20 minutes to fill it up. My job was to stand there with the scissors and cut it. Move that, put another one there, and wait. Listen, I have way too active a mind for this. Because my little invisible friends are talking to me while I'm waiting on that rope to fill up. And they're saying things like, we're thirsty, what are you doing here? Have you lost your mind? There's a party tonight. And so I'm headed back to Odessa, Texas. So, married again. Don't like to be without a wife, you know how that is. You feel like half a person. And I married a girl I just was crazy about. I mean, it was that puppy love, you know. This is the one. I mean, we were instantly sick together, you know. And it really got bad. And she had to leave me because I became so violent. With the combination of speed and whiskey and my thinking and my way of life and all those emotions, and I'm just getting worse by the minute, and I'm dangerous to be around. And she had to leave me. And when she left me, while she was gone, she was involved in a car wreck, and she was killed. And that became one more thing that I heaped on myself, and one more reason why I should drink and why my life is worse and why everybody else has something going on and everybody else has an advantage. And poor me, poor Danny. He doesn't have it. Never had a chance. Didn't have an education. I didn't have, I'd gone to up to the 10th grade. And I hadn't even done well in that. I've already been in mental institutions twice. I've been married three times at this point. And, you know, when all this happened, I went on a running drunk. Went on a running drunk with a friend of mine, and we got in a lot of trouble. And basically, the thing that really got me was we broke into a bar to burglarize it and, you know, take all their money and their booze and. But apparently we decided to stay and party. Cause I came to, and, you know, I was passed out on the pool table, and there was a detective with his flashlight in my face, and he said, oh hell, it's just Danny. And I felt so ashamed, you know. I was like, God, man, I don't like to get caught like this, you know. But I wound up getting 10 years in prison, and I went back to prison. And on the way down, I had my first conscious, really sane thought, and that is that, you know what, if you don't do something different, you're going to spend your life in prison, or somebody's going to kill you on the streets. And so when I got down there this time, I thought, okay, I'm going to get some help. And I quit smoking. I got a GED, which is a high school equivalent. I started taking college classes. I was going to major in English. I studied the dictionary. I read encyclopedias. I read philosophy. I took up yoga. I took up everything I could do. I got into creative visualization. I visualized how my life was going to be when I got out. I'm going to get out. I'm going to have my own house, my own car, and I'll grow my own marijuana so I don't have to interact with people. And I won't hang out with those bad people. And, I'll have a job. And I learned a little more about my family trade. They let me be an electrician in prison this time. And I became so changed that the warden agreed to let me go, and I got out in 3 years, and everything that I wanted to have happened. I had my own house, I had my own car, I had my first bank account. You know, I've got stereo, and I only drink beer, and only on the weekends. I have some long weekends. I worked for my dad. My dad owned an electrical company, and I'd work for him. From his perspective, it was so much better than what it had been, because I'm not on the front page. But all of that, you know, began to fall apart. And, I had everything I wanted, except I didn't have a wife. So I went looking for a wife. And the only place I know to look for one is in a bar, and I found her about the third night I was out. She was dancing on top of a table. I thought, that's my wife. And it took a while, but we got married. We had a big wedding. It was really, she lied. She wore white. And it was a big wedding, and the preacher was an AA guy. You know, I mean, he was really enjoying this, you know, I showed up to get married. My brother and I stopped for double shots all the way in. By the time we got there, when they pronounced us man and wife, I tried to put the ring on the wrong finger. They threw rice. I thought they were attacking us. I wound up with a black eye. My wife had a split lip, and we took off on our honeymoon. So, you know, it's just one thing. This is the girl that brought me to AA, by the way. And she became my drinking buddy. We got hepatitis. We just had a horrible way. Everything just went downhill, and I got sick. And I got to where I'd black out. I didn't know what was going on. I can't hold a job anymore. I'm back to hanging out with the people I always hung out with. And I'd sit there, and I would think, you know, I'd come to, and I'd think, what happened? Why am I back here again? You know, how come I don't have it together? I mean, I came this close, and now I'm like this close to prison again. And that's when I wound up running into you. You know, that was 27 years ago. 27 years ago, I stumbled in here, and I thought, what a big mistake. You know, because y'all are alcoholics. I'm a gangster. You know, not a real good one. But then from the way I think about things, y'all weren't very good alcoholics. You're in here not drinking. But I had a very difficult time. I liked Alcoholics Anonymous from the moment I met it. I mean, everybody in here, I love the laughter. I love the old guys that just laugh, you know, keep coming back. It's going to be all right. And you're like, hey, old fool, you know. And I finally had to leave Midland and go to Austin, Texas. I went to Austin, Texas, and I stole a car from a guy that was supposedly a friend of mine. I guess I'm not a very good friend. And anyway, I stole this car from him. It was a horrible car. He didn't even want it back. It was beat up. And I started wearing an eye patch, and there wasn't anything wrong with my eye. I just thought I looked really cool, you know. So I'm wearing an eye patch, I got a full beard, and I'm living in an old beat up stolen car, and I'm going to AA, you know. Ah, dang, man, you know, go into AA, man. And I got desire chip after desire chip, 30 days, 45 days, you know, and the people just say, keep coming back, keep coming back. And they just didn't criticize me, and they told me to keep coming back. I went to a meeting, anniversary meeting in Austin, Texas, and listened to an old guy talk, and he's passed away now, but he had 32 years, and I went in to listen to him talk, and I just had a couple of hours, and I tried to get up and leave, and he caught me before I left, and he held my hand, and he just said, you know, it's going to be all right, partner. It's going to be all right. You just come in here drunk. You come in here sober, but you come here. He says, no place else you belong. And I thought, well, why would he be nice to me? And he just smiled when he see me, and I wanted so much to impress him. Shortly after that, I met John Henry. God, I love John Henry. He was a fiery little Scots-Irish, you know, guy, and he just, he had everything I wanted, except sobriety. I didn't really want to be sober. I wanted all the benefits, but I didn't want to quit drinking, you know. Alcohol worked for me. Alcohol continued to work for me up until probably February the 17th. February the 18th, I got sober. I'd gone on a week-long drunk and just ripped and run, and life was just, I was at my wit's end. I was in East Austin, which is a really tough part of town. I was in the back seat of that car with three old Milwaukee beers. That's the worst beer in Texas. And I'm sitting here, and my liver is swollen. I've just blacked out again. I don't even know how I got there or how long I've been gone. All I know is that I had left a meeting. I'd left a meeting mad because I didn't like the subject, and I didn't like the old fools who always talk. And they always had to bring up the new guy because they were trying to shame me, is what I thought. My next conscious thought is a week later. A week later, and I'm sitting in the back of that car, and I mean, I'm hanging out, and I'm puking green bile, and it's yellow-green, and I'm sicker than a dog, and I'm just sweating, and I'm absolutely petrified. Now, I couldn't have walked from my car to the corner because my motor skills were shot. But all of my mind seemed to be focused, and all of that fear is there. And I mean, I'm aware I'm in a lot of trouble, and I just can't go on. And I said, God, I can't do this anymore. If you're real, if you can help me, I'll do anything because I want to be sober. I must have called AA because, these two old guys tell me, well, actually, there's one older guy and a new guy that was with him. We're doing a 12-step call, a traditional 12-step kind. Guy's got some time, and a new guy coming to get a guy that really wants to do this deal. And they come to get me, and they got me in the back seat of the car. Man, I'm feeling terrible. And I said, what do I do? And he said, the old guy said, Danny, if you don't drink, you won't get drunk. I said, I'm listening. And he said, you know, if you don't drink, you won't get drunk. And I said, how do you do that? He said, well, don't drink right now. And when right now passes, don't drink then either. and the new guy with him, he's a little bit of a smart aleck. He said, yeah, and pretty soon you'll have like a minute. Of course, the older guy, he chimes in. He says, oh, he said, listen, I'm going to tell you, those minutes will become hours. He said, those hours become days. They'll become weeks and years. And one day you'll find yourself a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, a self-respecting, sober man, a member of society. He said, that'll happen for you. I said, I want to do that. He said, okay. And he dropped me off at the AA club. I said, I can do this. I can do this. He got home. I called him from the club, and I said, I can't do this. He said, well, of course, we knew you couldn't. I said, well, what did you leave me here for if you knew I couldn't do it? He said, well, it's really not for us to know you can't do it. You're the one who has to know you can't do it. When you realize you can't do it, then you can do it. I said, okay. Well, what do I do? He said, don't drink. Go to those meetings, get a sponsor, read that book, take commitments, get involved in this thing. I said, I don't know anything. He said, I know you don't. And it's a good thing that you finally know it. you've been around here. He said, you could get rid of that eye patch for one thing. He said, that'd be a good start. Ain't nothing wrong with your eyes. So I got no eye patch. I'm focused. He said, empty ashtrays, help set up the room. Greet people. You know, ask, when people ask, you know, when you have a question, ask somebody. Learn to pray to whatever you conceive of as a higher power, whatever that is that you can personally conceive of. Forget all that you think you know. Only thing you need to know about a higher power is it's not you. And that's where my beginning was. So I did that thing. I understand what it is to be powerless over alcohol. I understand today that I have a physical allergy to alcohol. I had it from the very beginning. Some people get it as they drink. It happens. They cross an invisible line. I must have been born on the other side of that line. But I have an allergy to alcohol, and I have a mental obsession not to feel the way I feel, but to feel the way it made me feel that time when I was 13 and a half years old. That thing right there was so important to me, that to be able to feel that way. So I know what it is. And you know, the thing is, I wanted to believe that a power could restore me to sanity. And I took the third step. I wrote an inventory, and in that inventory I shared it with my sponsor. And I had it was a long afternoon, and when it was done, he said, why don't you go down by Town Lake and you think about what you just shared. He said, because basically what we have here is a liar, a cheat, and a thief. And if you want to live like that, you don't need our help. You're really good at it. He said, but if you want this way of life, you have to be different. And there's no middle ground with us. It's all or nothing at this point. And I said, I want to do this. So I went down by Town Lake, and when I went down there, I got out of that car, and I was going to do it right out of the book, the sixth and seventh. I got out of that car, and I felt this power just wash through me. I felt like I was in this protective umbrella. I felt this great clean wind in me, and I said, so this is the higher power. This is God. And I said, man, I'm healed. I'm free. I don't ever have to drink again. Don't have to live like this anymore. I can go back and teach those old people at AA about God. And turned out wrong. But the thing is, when you set a slave free, when you set a man who's been a slave to alcohol all of his life free, he doesn't know anything but slavery. You've got to be taught a new way of living. You're just beginning your journey. And thank God for the fellowship, and thank God for the people who taught me how to talk, how to dress, taught me how to pursue a career, taught me about life right here. I grew up right here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I know that you want me to wind this up. I got two things that I don't ever want to not share. When I got sober, I did really well. I went out and did some of the eighth and ninth step stuff, and life is good, and I got a job, and I got a little place, and I got a girlfriend, of course, you know. I got to have that right away, you know. But I'm not marrying her because I'm married, and I already know, because I'm learning from my past now. You can't have two at once. But you know, my life is reasonably good, and I'm in AA, and I'm growing up. But I began to get very, very restless, irritable, and discontent. And I decided I needed to go to a more spiritual meeting, so I went across the town, because I said, man, these people I'm hanging with, they ain't got it, because I'm about to implode. And I went to this old guy, and I listened to him talk, and everybody just ooh and ahed when he talked. And when it was over, I said, I need some help, because if you don't help me, I'm going to smoke a 45. And he said, well, you know, we had a talk. And he said, well, what I do every day is that I wake up in the morning and I say, I'm a sober, healthy, happy, handsome, and exciting, loving child of God. I said, really? He said, that works for me. So the next morning I woke up, I was in my car, I tilted the rearview mirror, and I said, I am a sober, healthy, happy, handsome, exciting, loving child of God. Oh, this is not working for me. So I broke down and I called John Henry and I said, John, I need to talk to you. And he said, yeah, you do. And I got with him and he said, listen, I told him about my affirmation. He said, well, the reason it's not working is because it's not true. And he said, he said, Danny, some of us have real bad cases of alcoholism and you're one of them. And he said, listen, what's standing between you and that higher power that you met down on the shores of Town Lake is what's written on that 8-step list. And he said, that's what you address that and you'll presently live in a new world. Chuck C. says it's uncovering, discovering, and discarding old ideas and old ways. It's healing new. It's healing old relationships so that you can suddenly, it's not that you learn a lot of stuff, it's you let go of a lot of stuff and you suddenly realize you really belong here. You really are a child of the universe. You really have a right and a purpose. And that's not going to happen when you've got all of that wreckage in your heart and in your life. And I said, well, I got a problem. I said, I've been my parole officer, who I've not reported to since I've been sober or before, has let me know that they want to talk to me about a bank robbery in San Angelo, Texas. And they got it on video, and it's a tall guy with a beard and glasses and a cowboy hat and a gun going from till to till. And they are looking for you. And I'm a blackout drinker. I have no idea where I was. And I said, I can't do that because I'll go to prison for the rest of my life. He said, well, Danny, you need to get you a new sponsor, because if you don't do it, you're going to be drunk. And I don't sponsor drunk people. I sponsor sober men. And he said, so you need to make the call. And I said, well, I can't do it. He said, you told me you were willing to go to any length. I said, that's theory. They will lock me up forever for this. And that night I sat in that car and I just was eat up with fear. And I sat there for a while and I thought about it and I said, finally, I said, God, I can't do it. I don't have the courage. If you want me to do it, and if you're real, you're going to have to help me. And I felt the peace come over me again. And the thought that came to me is that I now have a freedom inside of me that I never had in my whole life. And I was going to have to make a choice between my physical freedom or my inner freedom. I couldn't have both. And I said, okay, I can do this. And man, I was just eat up with fear. I went down to that police station. I walked in, and that guy, I told him who I was. He said, where you been? I said, I'm in an AA. Man, I started telling him all about my service work and my, you know, I want to try to clean up a little bit. He looked at, he showed, I want to show you something. He played that video twice, and I watched it with him. It was grainy, but as I watched it, I thought, I wonder what I did with the money. And when it was over, he looked at me and he said, the guy I'm looking for wouldn't walk in here. The guy I'm looking for is out there and I'll catch him. He said, you need to go back there with those people from AA. He said, they have a good idea about what life's about. And he said, you need to get over there and help them and let them help you. And y'all do something for society. Man, I walked out and thought, I'm in AA forever. This is the only deal. The last thing, and I'll make this quick, I'm going to tell you about my dad. My dad is absolutely my hero. He's a World War II veteran, and he's like, now he's 82 years old. And I guess because it's my anniversary and I've been thinking about him, that I'm very emotional about it tonight. But when I was really young, and he came back from Second World War, he'd had a lot of trouble because there's a lot of stuff they had to deal with, those guys that fought. And, you know, he was a tough man and a two-fisted drinker. But he'd play out with me. He loved me. And we'd play out in South Texas, out in the backyard. And when I remember him as a big, strong guy, but he didn't wear a shirt and drinking cold beer and listening to country and Western music. We'd play, and when he was done, one day he lay down and he lay my head on his bare chest, and I went to sleep. And as I went to sleep, I felt safe because this is my dad. Nothing can hurt me. This disease just tore us apart. I mean, we just, our whole family, we just tortured by it until we met you. And I got sober. My dad and I, we had a little amends thing. My mom arranged it. She said, a chair here and a chair here. You know, and we sat down and y'all, you know, she just stand there and wait for us to do it. And I went through and I admitted things. And my dad basically said, you know, that's great. I'm glad you're sober. Good for you. Get you a job. And so over the years that I've been sober, my dad has said, you know, I would hear from my brothers and my mother and people in the community, your dad's very proud of you. He's very grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous. He thanks the world of you. But he never would tell me. We had that wall between us, you know. We would come near, but we just couldn't connect. And when I was about 18 years sober, I went to where they live, and I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I came in and I talked to my mom for a minute, and I said, is he asleep? And she said, he's back there pretending to be. And I went back to where he was, and he's this, you know, time has worn him down. He's a little short, bald-headed guy that's, you know, he's a sweet man. And he's laying in bed, and I said, I leaned down to kiss him on his head, and I said, I love you, Pop. And he held my head to his chest. And when he did, I just said, Pop, I didn't know what to do. And he said, me neither. He said, I didn't know what to do. He said, you tell those people at Alcoholics Anonymous how much we love them and how much they mean to our family and how grateful I am to have you for a son and the man that you've become. He said, always tell them how much that you mean to us. So I'm telling you tonight that you mean everything to my family. I stand here tonight 25 years sober with them. My mother and dad can go to their grave in peace, knowing that their son not only can take care of himself, but he is in an organization that has purpose, and it drives my life. I can't tell you how much I love you. And if you're new here, please do yourself a favor. Just stay. Listen. And if you're here for a while and you got all twisted up, you know, and you let those, your little friends talking to you again, and you don't know which way to turn, you know, swallow your pride. Find somebody that's just willing to sit down and talk to you. Any of us are. And talk to that guy. This, all this is one-on-one, kneecap to kneecap. Nobody's ahead of anybody here. I'm up here talking. I have no idea why anybody could take my place. My place is out there sitting with you. I love you all, and thank you so much for the trip over here. God bless.
Everyone's ready for a bite to eat, so can we just close with a serenity prayer, please, and remember the alcoholic who still suffers. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can. Anything else? No, no. Keep coming back.
They obviously inexperienced. My grandmother died in an insane asylum.